to the Omo Variety Hour. I am Cecil Prescott, and for my co-host Celeste Carey, we bid you a good day.
Tune in every first Tuesday of the month from 6 to 7 p.m. for Transpositive PDX on KBOO for unique programming addressing the transgender, non-binary, two-spirit, and gender non-conforming communities in Portland and beyond. This month's show will focus on providing information about non-binary genders, and will also give information on the June Pride Parade and Trans Pride March. That's every first Tuesday of the month from 6 to 7 p.m. on 90.7 FM KBOO Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Lost Boys of Portlandia, a film premiere gala and fundraiser for Outside the Frame, Tuesday, June 7th at 7 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. Outside the Frame is a new organization that empowers homeless and marginalized youth by producing films with youth that convey their life experience. They will premiere The Lost Boys of Portlandia, a riff on Peter Pan, where real lost boys and girls debate if and how to return to mainstream society. They will also screen original film shorts by homeless youth about issues such as drug abuse, gender identity, and the healthcare system. Again, that's The Lost Boys of Portlandia, Tuesday, June 7th at 7 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts, presenting from the Buena Vista Social Club, Omara Portuando and Aledes Ochoa, Sunday, August 28th at the Oregon Zoo. Doors open at 5, the show starts at 7, and tickets and information from the Buena Vista Social Club are available at zooconcerts.com. And good morning. You are listening to the Omo Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Welcome. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kullberg is engineering. The Omo is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromised news media. I ain't got no quarrel with them Viet Cong. Those are the famous words of the great boxer Muhammad Ali in declining to participate in the U.S. police action in Vietnam. Muhammad Ali died last Friday from complications of Parkinson's disease. Though vilified by many in the Vietnam War era as a coward and a traitor, the truth was just the opposite. He risked his entire boxing career to take a principled stand against an unjust and criminal war. Denied a license to box for 3.5 years after his refusal, he came back to regain his heavyweight boxing title from George Foreman in a fight that took place in Zaire in 1974 and is famously known as the Rumble in the Jungle. But it is what he did with his life after his boxing career is behind him that he will be most honorably remembered. It was his unceasing work as a humanitarian ambassador to the world that made him so beloved by so many. Today we acknowledge his life and dedicate this program to his memory. On today's program, Bill Resnick interviews Lori Wallach of Global Trade Watch, discussing why U.S. trade policy has become a central issue in the presidential primaries of both big parties, which have been complicit in creating trade policies that so advantages the rich and undermines working people. Jan Hocken will be talking with Judy Roth, a clinical psychologist and psychoanalyst in the New York City who is active with Psychologists for Social Responsibility. They will be discussing Roth's work in conflict zones and what she terms responsible accompaniment. Roth has carried out a series of projects in Israel and Palestine over the past decade involving creating supportive spaces for people experiencing ongoing trauma, particularly focused on the effects of the occupation on Palestinian mothers and children. Portland Public Schools have recently declared that climate science denial in the district's textbooks must be eliminated. Some are crying censorship, while others say it merely mandates a scientific-based appraisal of reality. Denise Morris is here to discuss the issue. But now here's Bill Resnick with Lori Wallach of Global Trade Watch.
Thanks, Tom. Lori Wallach, welcome to KABU.
Good morning.
Well, you're enthusiastic. That's good. Lori Wallach is the director and founder of Global Trade Watch. It's a division of Public Citizen. She writes on trade policy, opposes the corporate version of what they call free trade, but which is hardly free, and it's thousands of pages of rules work to the benefit of the corporate elites who have been writing the laws and, of course, injure working people across the world. Global Trade Watch rather supports and proposes fair trade policies and enforceable standards and rules that would benefit the 99% and also, of course, contribute to saving the planet. So, Lori, it's another election season. The presidential primaries are ending. It had to be really fascinating for you, as, of course, was the Obama-Romney battle in 2012, especially this one, the primaries, because trade policy became the major issues for both parties. In fact, all the candidates were forced to stake out positions. Pretty much all of them had to be critical. We'll be talking about the positions of all the major candidates and particularly how fair trade is being presented. But first, Lori, why now? Why did trade policy flare up in the primaries?
I think there are two factors. One is that there are very few policies that are more emblematic of corporate power and control than our so-called trade policy. At the heart of agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership is an investor privileges regime that literally elevates individual foreign investors and companies to equal status with entire nation states that have signed an agreement through the investor state dispute resolution system. Any individual investor can sue an entire government as if they were an equal country, but they get to privately enforce this public treaty demanding taxpayer compensation for any government action or policy that they think violates the new investor rights and privileges that the agreement would give them. And this provision, this incredible formalization of corporate power, I think has become, since Senator Elizabeth Warren really started to publicize and popularize it a year ago, an issue that has made much clearer for people that agreements like the TPP aren't about so-called trade. They are a corporate empowerment tool that sets up new rights and privileges for corporations and that limits the ability of people to make the decisions that will affect their lives or governments to regulate in our public interest.
Yeah, Lori, why don't you give us a few examples of how private, mostly corporations, but also individuals have sued governments to stop them from doing things like having a universal health service and many other sort of maneuvers.
Well, these corporate lawsuits, the investor state suits, the system that is part of the TPP, I mean, examples are, for instance, a toxic waste dump that in Mexico has been shut down by the government.
Lori, talk right into your phone. Yes. We're having trouble hearing you.
I'm sorry. Is this better?
Yes.
Hopefully. One example, just for instance, is a state government in Mexico denied a U.S. company the right to reopen a toxic waste dump that had been shut down as polluting the groundwater when a previous owner, a Mexican company, had owned it. But under NAFTA, which has a smaller version of these investor rights, the foreign investor said, well, maybe you can regulate the domestic company, but if we're a NAFTA investor, we have absolute rights as investors. So either you have to let us open this toxic waste dump and pollute, poison the water of the city, or you have to compensate us. And the decisions are made by the tribunal of three private attorneys. The corporations pay them by the hour. And it's basically a corporate parallel system of injustice where the companies don't have to follow the domestic laws or use the domestic courts, but can hire private attorneys to, and many of the attorneys rotate between suing governments for the companies and acting as judges. And it's unlimited how much they can make taxpayers pay. So in this instance, the government of Mexico was ordered to pay $14 million to the company that was treated exactly the same as the previous company that was Mexican that owned the toxic waste dump.
Laurie, please talk right into the phone. You fade out.
Another example that's happening right now is a challenge against Quebec, Canada's moratorium on fracking. They have a moratorium on fracking, and there's an American company that's demanding hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation because the people in this province in Canada have decided there needs to be more scientific examination of what would happen to the water system, to pollution, if fracking continues, particularly under the St. Lawrence River, which is the main water source for the province of Quebec. So these are real cases. Philip Morris right now is suing against tobacco regulation. Chevron has been paid out tens of millions. Occidental Petroleum has been paid out billions. Has been ordered in a case of polluting the Amazon to be paid billions. Financial firms are getting paid off after they have attacked financial regulations. Water companies. It is a corporate attack regime. And people are getting aware of that. The second thing I think that's happened is more people are aware that the trade agreements never live up to their economic promises. So people in Oregon are constantly being told, Oregon's a winner in trade. We have to have trade agreements. You know who's saying that? That's Intel. That's Nike. They don't make their stuff here anyway. They want to be able to sell it here duty-free after they make it in Vietnam or someplace with horrible labor conditions. But actually, if you look practically, even at the official government study about the TPP, Oregon stands to lose. This official study by the International Trade Commission, which was released 2 weeks ago, shows that for the 17 manufacturing sectors that they examined, that for Oregon is almost 100,000 jobs in Oregon, 100,000 jobs in those sectors. That 16 of the 17 sectors for Oregon would be losers, which means that would be 95,000 jobs at risk in sectors of manufacturing in Oregon, everything from electronics manufacturing to chemicals, all of the high-end manufacturing. And the only winning sector in Oregon for manufacturing is petroleum and coal products, and it's a total of 500 jobs. Well, then you look at agriculture, and the number one Oregon agricultural product, of course, is wheat. And the official government study says that wheat will decline in exports under the TPP, and there'll be more imports. So the trade deficit will increase. So for Oregon, practically, the economics being projected by this government study that is always too optimistic. These are the studies that said NAFTA would be great and there'd be no new trade deficit with China, all proved wrong. So the optimistic study says Oregon's a net loser. And people are living this experience. They are seeing what has happened under the past agreements. They know for themselves, for their neighbors, for their friends, the job loss, the wages, the higher medicine prices, and they've had it. And I think that's what's animating this.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Lori Wallach, a director and founder of Global Trade Watch. We've been discussing why trade policies suddenly become national policies during election season, because people have woken up to what's in fact happening to them, the much greater insecurity, the inequality, the decline of wages, the working harder for less. It has lots of course, sources for that decline, including attacking unions and mobility within the United States, the race to the bottom by corporations who are putting pressure on every source of employee income or benefits. Lori, Obama was very critical of trade policy, for example, in the 2016 run for election. And so, in fact, was Romney, even though he was more supportive. In office, Obama then became a fervent advocate of the TPP and fast track and not permitting a real debates on trade and just pushing it through. How do you explain that?
I think that the time was different in that President Obama felt pressure from the top, from campaign officials looking at the polling to say the right thing, and from some of the organized interests that are Democratic base interests. What's different this time, which is why I actually think, for instance, it is within our ability to end the TPP once and for all, is that the demand is coming from the bottom up. It's not just Democrats, it's Republicans too. Across the country, people have hit what I sometimes call the basta moment. They have just had it. And so instead of seeing it become a partisan issue where Democrats take one position and Republicans take the other, rather, if you want to be a candidate who is viable in this presidential cycle, Democrat or Republican, you need to be saying you will stop the TPP. And so you have, for instance, all three of the main presidential candidates all saying, number one, they oppose the TPP, and number two, they certainly oppose it being voted on in the lame duck session of Congress, which is the current plan. After the election, the least amount of accountability, when members of Congress who've been retired or fired can basically decide to come back and vote for their next corporate job, that is when they want to have the votes, because the votes are not there right now. And some of the members of Congress, actually, who will make the decision are right there in the Portland listening audience area. Congresswoman Bonamici, Congressman Blumenauer, Congressman Schrader. Those are some of the very, very few House Democrats who have not already joined Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders, the Democratic candidates for president, in saying no way on TPP. They are amongst the very few Democrats who have not come out flat opposed. And when push comes to shove, it's going to be some of the Oregon members who decide whether or not we live with the disaster of TPP. Because if there's a majority in Congress, it doesn't matter if the agreement's signed. If a majority's against, it's not going to happen.
This is your Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. That was Lori Wallach of Global Trade Watch pointing out the importance of influencing U.S. Congress representatives Blumenauer, Bonamici, and Schrader, all in the close to or in this metropolitan area. You know, we were going to talk about what the various positions of the candidates. It seems to me, well, one of them, of course, is radically and crazily protectionist in some ways and building walls. Indeed, he still may win, but the interesting positions, at least, are those who want to make some changes in, quote, free trade, and those who would substitute fair trade for free trade. We only have another about, what, 4 minutes? 2 minutes. Characterize the two positions. Why should we... 4 minutes. Why should we support free trade? Why should we support fair trade?
So I think the most important thing for your listeners to understand is that the concept of free trade or trade agreements have been hijacked. So the TPP is no more a trade agreement than I am a giraffe. You can call me a giraffe, but I am not a giraffe. The trade agreement that we would want is one that, number one, only deals with trade. So the TPP is packed with all kinds of special interest provisions. It's like the good name of trade got hijacked, and all this other crap got glued in. So imagine a trade agreement, this is in TPP, that has new monopolies and protectionism for the big pharmaceutical companies to raise medicine prices. It's literally language to stop competition that would bring down prices. Or imagine the language that extends copyright that would undermine internet freedom. What the heck is that doing in a trade agreement? Or the language on procurement, government expenditures of our tax dollars that forbid buy local, which of course we need for climate purposes, but also to reinvest our tax dollars at home. The fix, the fair trade fix, is to cut away all of the garbage that has been attached to the trade agreements. Why? Because the process is secret negotiations with corporate trade advisors, officially security cleared, seeing the draft text that Congress can't even see, much less the public, and having the say on what the U.S. position is. So 600 advisors, 550 of them corporate, they literally, for TPP, put all this protectionist, special interest, monopolistic stuff under the brand name of free trade. So all that garbage has to be cleared out. No procurement rules, no protectionism for the big content industry for copyright extensions, no protectionism for big pharma and extensions of medicine patents. Get rid of the limits on financial regulation that are in there, the limits on food safety. You can imagine there are even limits on labeling. And not just GMOs, everything, but there's terrible GMO language in there. All that baggage needs to be taken off the train. Then we need to fix the trade part. And the biggest fix of the trade part is to actually make sure that competition in the global economy is happening on the basis of a floor of decency. Right now we have competition like at the turn of the century between the U.S. states when there were no federal laws. We have global corporations and globalization, and we have no global rules that are enforceable. So trade agreements should condition the benefits, the tax cuts on trade, on companies meeting the global standards that already are there, so that nation states, basically as sovereigns, have already adopted labor standards under the International Labor Organization, multilateral environmental agreements, human rights treaties under the UN. But none of these are strongly enforced. And in fact, if there's a conflict, the trade agreements specifically trump them. So we need to reverse that. We need to make those global human standards a floor upon which every company that seeks to get the benefits of the trade agreements must meet the standards. And then finally, we need rules to stop what's called currency manipulation. Right now, even when a place like Oregon, Eastern Oregon, you guys do great in wheat. You should be able to export some of that wheat. But a lot of countries will basically devalue the price of their currency against the dollar. And then as a result, it gets too expensive to send a U.S. export to that country, even though prices are competitive. It's a manipulation of the exchange rate.
We need
rules in the trade agreements that actually, number one, put a floor of human decency on which competition occurs, and number two, get rid of the cheating.
Laurie, we have to sign off.
Clean out all that extra stuff. The investor special privileges and tribunals, the extensions of the patents, all the garbage goes out, the right trade rules go in, and those are trade agreements that could
Laurie, we have to sign off. Let me suggest. Yes, we have to finish. Let me suggest people should go to the website Global Trade Watch. All of those details are there, and there's also a study of Oregon and ways in which people in Oregon can influence the fate of this horrible TPP agreement. Thanks a lot for talking to us today, Lori Wallach of Global Trade Watch.
Thank you.
This is the OMO Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. The KBOO mobile app is the best way to listen to KBOO on your Android, iPhone, or iPad. Access the world of KBOO in one simple app you can download for free. Let your imagination run wild on how cool instantaneous access to KBOO can be. Discussions can get started, points can be proven, jams can get discovered, all from your smartphone or mobile device. Look up KBOO in Google Play or an iTunes App Store and download the KBOO app today. Now Jan Hawken talks with Judy Roth, an activist with Psychologists for Social Responsibility, on her work with Israeli and Palestinian trauma victims.
Welcome to KBOO, Judy Roth.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be speaking with you.
Well, yesterday there was a massive Israeli police presence in Jerusalem to protect marchers celebrating Israel's 1967 invasion and subsequent occupation of the Palestinian-dominated eastern half of the city, which Arabs call the Nakba, or the catastrophe. On June 5th, 1967, Israel invaded Palestinian, Egyptian, and Syrian territories at once. 6 days later, it had occupied the Sinai Peninsula, Gaza Strip, West Bank, and Golan Heights. Israel's occupation and annexation of East Jerusalem in 1967 has never been recognized by the international community. Well, Judy, you've been working in Israel and Palestine for a number of years now, including your recent trip. Let's start with the situation in Jerusalem and the psychological toll of the occupation of East Jerusalem. What can you report from your visit?
Well, let me do a zoom out first and say that it's actually an anniversary for me as well. I actually started getting to know East Jerusalem exactly 10 years ago when it was close to the 40th anniversary, going into the 40th year of the occupation of East Jerusalem and the West Bank and Golan Heights. And I had spent a lot of time in Israel. My mother and father had spent time there after the Holocaust, and I had been an exchange student there. And while I thought I knew Israel and I thought I knew Jerusalem, when I was introduced to what was going on in East Jerusalem, it was like Rome was burning. I could not believe the level of devastation, human rights abuses, and violations, particularly as they were impacting families. And that this is now we're talking, I mean, it's been going on for a very long time. I was getting abreast of this 10 years ago. And I can only say that the situation has gotten worse over the past 10 years, particularly as it affects children.
And that is, much of your work does focus on women and children, families. You know, psychologists, including many leading psychologists from the U.S. and from the psychoanalytic community who are progressive, pro-Palestinian, have worked in Palestine and Israel for some time and other conflict zones, often involved in dialogue projects or reconciliation projects. Can you speak a bit about some of the pitfalls of those projects and what you've learned over time about the contributions and the limits of psychologists working in conflict zones?
Sure. So first of all, I have to say that you know, I think most of the projects that I've come encountered over time have come from really good places, people wanting to make a difference, people wanting to work towards peace and reconciliation. Where I feel like they get misguided is that this is an ongoing conflict zone with really no end in sight. And so what does it mean to engage dialogue when violations are happening on the ground at the very same time? And it seems to me that the very first step, which is the hardest step, is to see and learn about those violations, and psychologists to know how they're impacting the psyche. This is not the only place in the world where racism, oppression, occupation, evacuations, and so forth have, you know, penetrated the soul of a person. But they're ongoing and they're relentless, and there's a lot we can learn about that and then try to disrupt and amplify, I think.
Many of our models of trauma, and certainly the kind of prototype of post-traumatic stress syndrome and therapeutic interventions in general, assume that things have settled down enough for people to be able to represent in mind and reflect on what's happened, that there is something overwhelming that now is past enough to work with in a different way. But your work is in the middle of ongoing violence and trauma.
Right. I mean, you know, it was so interesting when I first started learning about it, both on the Palestinian side and on the Israeli side. There were many, many, many people who subscribed to PTSD models, but there was no PTSD. There's no post here. So then the question is, what do you just say, no healing till the occupation is over, which could be who knows when? So what kind of presence can we bring? And again, as outsiders, you know, I subscribe to the thought that you have to be extremely careful, that you are, you know, you're available or recruitable only insofar as you're invited in and somebody wants to think together with you or wants you to witness. So, you know, it's a very challenging space in which to stand.
And you use terms like accompaniment and responsible witnessing. It sounds like even the struggle with that language suggests some problems over time in kind of the enormous currency of terms like witnessing that can take on almost a sacral tone. And the question is, who's witnessing what, and what is the point of that? Are people involved outside the area in some kind of personal quest for meaning? And, you know, the interventions of outsiders have long been suspect in such situations. So it sounds like part of your aim is to be very modest about what you're proposing.
And, you know, only to step in if that is desired. I mean, I had the privilege about 4 years ago of engaging with a human rights activist from Ramallah who was long time studying the impact, Palestinian herself, of the occupation and violence on women's lives. And we went in and interviewed women living at the friction points. That's those are the points where Israeli settlers are stationed, and those are very dangerous places. And what was the impact of night raids, and what was the impact of the detention of their children and arrest of children? And we learned a tremendous amount about the kind of anticipatory terror that women are living with, the fear of being inducted into a frontline vortex where, you know, kind of all of their hopes and dreams for a kind of normal life they would have to relinquish, and then they were kind of inducted into something which is kind of like, you know, what Martin Barrow wrote about, the kind of normal abnormality, you know, where large sweeps of the neighborhood and mapping of the neighborhoods to pick up children was normalized, where the detention of their own kids was normalized. And that's, you know, so was that helpful? Is that helpful witnessing? Did it infuse human rights advocacy? We won't know.
But the witnessing, go ahead.
No, we certainly learned a tremendous amount about the kinds of traumas that, you know, in the way that psychoanalysts talk about, that are seeking to inscribe themselves. These are, you know, Martin Bergman, who's a very famous psychoanalyst, used to say that there's nothing more ferocious than a mother's dream and a mother's claim. And so you would see these very young mothers really freaking out. You know, they were taking pills at night, and there was, you know, praying to Allah because they didn't know what to do about this induction into a life that was really perverse in some ways. And so that's what we wrote about. That's what we talked about. Does it make a difference? Who knows?
And There are responsibilities, moral responsibilities as well as political ones that accompany these testimonials. And so in that sense, it's not the same as many field research projects. Often field research does carry moral obligations to participants, but these must weigh very heavily on you.
Absolutely. And again, because it's a live, active war zone where there has been no reconciliation process, no accountability, no reparation. You know, I've been involved with the Truth Commission project, and we interviewed this one amazing man. He actually volunteered for the project, and he was in his 60s, and we came to see him. He's a grandfather, and it was clear that he'd become psychically stranded when he began to think about what he had done during his military service and what his father had done and what his children were doing and now what his grandchildren were about to do. And he invited us in, and we talked, and we learned about what he did. And he was involved with nighttime arrests. This is like, you know, 30, 40 years ago. The very thing that I was studying with Palestinians a few years before. And there we were, and we, you know, I really felt for him. We were building kind of a space for him to step through the looking glass, you know, which is a very painful process when you realize your life has either been wasted or your collective identifications are wrong. And yet at the same time, what did it mean to spend the time with him to talk about perpetrator trauma when the other side is really, there's, you know, are, it's asymmetrical. It's, you know, that side is, the Palestinian side is really under fire. So those are the kind of ethical questions, you know, that are just really hard to handle.
And particularly that knowledge that perpetrators of all sorts bring their own histories and are dehumanized by these scenes of violence and oppression. But how do you both acknowledge that while at the same time the focus has to be on the primary victims?
Right. I mean, you know, it is like the perfect storm of politics, ethics, and psychology all together right there, right? You know, where do you position yourself? And I often take a lot of, I guess, solace or inspiration from some of the people who worked in South Africa and Pumla Madikizela, who wrote A Human Being Died Last Night, you know, where she really sought out to understand the perpetrator and to humanize him and was very aware that we could, you know, it's sort of arbitrary what side we end up on sometimes, right? It's you don't actually always get to choose.
And she took a lot of flack for that, her fascination with him.
That's right.
I think sometimes those projects can be misunderstood as being kind of seduced and fascinated by the powerful people who've been so destructive. But I think there is in many of those projects an attempt to understand these dynamics more deeply, because so many people in the world are not easily cast singularly as victim or perpetrator, but often over time occupy both positions. And so it's important who we cast as irredeemably evil and outside the fold of humanity.
Absolutely. And in Israel-Palestine, you can be a perpetrator and a bystander and a victim all at the same time. You know, that's the irony of this thing. I mean, vis-a-vis the occupation, you might not be, but, you know, that there are many people who are carrying historical traumas with them and a lot of PTSD. So
what do you...
Yeah, go ahead.
What do you... maybe in the minutes we have left, we could talk some about where you take this work to the U.S. and other places in the world. I know you're going to an upcoming conference in Salzburg, dealing with some of these issues. Of course, conferences are places where you speak with other professionals. And I know your work and the work of Psychologists for Social Responsibility go beyond presenting at conferences. What are your hopes for these testimonials as they are distributed and mobilize people in solidarity elsewhere in the world?
So I think there are different pathways, and you have to keep working on the different pathways. Of course, it takes energy, and sometimes I have to ask myself where I'm going to get the energy or other people are going to get the energy, because it's very high burnout work for the people kind of disseminating this information. But I think it's also, I think there's a lot of one-on-one and trying to reach two people who are in key positions to hear, to maybe influence, to speak to, whether they're clergy or people in politics or in lobbies who encourage them to go to the region, to write about the region, or to know about these realities. So I think that's one piece of it. I think another piece is that unlike, I mean, therapy deals with trauma too, but here you are right up in your face with ongoing trauma. I mean, when I was just now in Palestine, I was in Hebron and met with a family that the night before there was a nighttime arrest. And, you know, you could feel the deadness that comes with trauma, with being in that register of, you know, what Lacan said, the real. And so the question is, how do you get these testimonies out so they can be heard? And there's a lot of work about that. I mean, I think movies help, and the kind of work that you do, and theater can help, and poetry, music. I mean, one really has to think, who do you reach to who can hear this and then amplify it in a way that other people can take it in and then be galvanized too?
Yeah, and there's been quite a bit of work internationally on how helpful it is to get people to talk about something in the midst of their experiencing of it, and many caveats about that can actually be extremely problematic, that people need to be able to repress, in a sense, to shut out of mind part of their experience to continue to function. I think as part of what you must bring as a psychoanalytic activist to this is maybe some comfort with stillness, being present with a lot of intense feeling. I'm probably anger toward you as an outsider at times, your own impotence, but to be able to kind of tolerate some of those intense feelings and not having to say something often or do anything, but to kind of be another presence that maybe works against the extreme isolation of people in these situations.
Yeah, I think that's really a good point. It's the extreme isolation and it's the extreme reactivity that's going on around them. So the idea of just sitting still and reflecting, and, you know, there's the challenge, as you're saying, about not re-traumatizing. And sometimes in telling a story and the compulsion to tell a story, people do re-traumatize themselves, and sort of how to create a presence. You know, often I circle back with the people I've gotten to meet, or somebody I've been with will circle back so that we're kind of tracking what's going on. And I think the other piece is also, you know, you're not just seeking out how people experience trauma. You're also seeking out how people are living with trauma.
Yeah.
And how they're, you know, and people, I mean, I've been amazed how people are, in the midst of, like, terrible situations, kind of reflexively seek out the humane.
Yeah, and people cook their meals and have sex and children play and under often really incredible conditions. So just in closing, there's a website that you've been part of called Born Equal, www.bornequal.com. Is that one place people can find out more about the work?
Yes, born-equal.net.
Oh, born-equal.net.
.net. Yes.
Okay, well, thanks so much for being with
Thank
us
you.
Today, Judith Roth,
really appreciate it.
Psychologist, activist, and good luck with that conference in Salzburg. Maybe we can get a report on that as well when you're back.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Keep
care,
up
bye-bye.
The good work. Bye.
KBOO Portland. Now Denise Morris and Bill Resnick are here to discuss the controversy that erupted over the Portland Public School District's banning of textbooks that present climate change denial as a legitimate scientific viewpoint.
Thank you, Tom, and I am here with Bill Resnick, who on May 16th, the May 16th Old Mole, Bill, you interviewed teacher activist Jan Zuckerman about the resolution to be presented that next day, Tuesday, May 17th. The resolution passed unanimously, and this morning we will dig into the aftermath and look more critically at the resolution. In particular, Bill, you have some really good ideas about what climate literacy could look like, but we'll try to unpack the controversy and bring to the surface some of the issues that aren't maybe being talked about, because that's what we do here on the Old Mole.
Right. You know, my position is we should really teach climate change denial, but not teach it as a scientific fact, but as the basic superstition. The same way we teach the Salem witch trials. We don't say you can't have it in textbooks. What we do say is you've got to really examine it and the craziness of it.
Right, and this is a huge part of why I think there's a lot of room for the firestorm of controversy to ignite, where there's a lot of discussion about censorship and book burning and on and on. Let me just quote a little bit from the article in Common Dreams, Bill Bigelow from Rethinking Schools, who was also part of this process and involved in the creation of the Rethinking Schools book, A People's Curriculum for the Earth, Teaching Climate Change and the Environmental Crisis. Just a little bit, it'll give us a little bit of context for the resolution. He says, in what may be the first in the nation, this week the Portland, Oregon School Board passed a sweeping climate justice resolution that commits the school district to, quote, abandon the use of any adopted text material that is found to express doubt about the severity of the climate crisis or its root in human activity. The resolution further commits the school district to develop a plan to address climate change and climate justice in all Portland public schools. The resolution makes climate literacy a priority. So this is sort of the context of the agreement, let's say. What's very interesting and important about this resolution is that it builds on the movement that was created to bring the resolution forward to make sure that, as you've mentioned, Bill, we're not just going back to find some better corporate textbook. We're actually wanting to build the community within the school system and outside of it to connect students, families, parents, teachers, et cetera, in the process of creating this new curriculum.
Yeah, it seems to me it's a wonderful first step. And particularly, it's a signal to the real censors and book burners. I mean, it's a great irony that the teachers of Portland are being called book burners when, in fact, the reason these textbooks are so terrible, the publishers are not interested in climate change denial. These same publishers are publishing books on the severity of climate change and the need for action. They're doing it because the radically conservative groups, especially in Texas, where the state school board has a committee that evaluates textbooks, they look at the textbooks that are presented to them, and they cross out stuff and they add things that they want to see, and then they tell the publishers of all textbooks, if you continue, these are draft textbooks, if you continue with this stuff, Texas will not buy them. We want something different. And so these textbooks are not because the publishers are sort of committed to these relatively bizarre and completely unscientific ideas, or there's very little evidence for them. It's because the Texas Book Commission and the others won't buy their text unless they fudge things and give climate change denial a lot of space and favorable space and call things debates, as if there's a debate between creationism and evolution. There's no debate, really. It's sort of settled scientifically. Creationism is a religious sort of belief, and it can be presented that our people believe that, but there's lots of evidence that's on the other side. Let's see, where are we, Denise?
Well, it's really in the context of all of the broader issues that we confront in public education. So are we looking to create good stewards of the earth and society through our public schools, or are you know, who's doing the real indoctrination is really what's coming to the forefront.
Yes, that's the question. And this thing by the school board is very important nationally. Because of that, it challenges the whole system now of textbook creation and how they work, as well as and it's part of a bigger challenge of what's worth teaching, what do we want our students to learn, what should be on these innumerable tests that they're forced to take. It has repercussions in all those areas. So, of course, conservatives would just are now apoplectic that anybody would want to teach real science. Now, the question, though, is what's real science? I think that's a question for the people who are designing curriculums that they have to face.
Right, and embedded in all this, for me, is the connection between the roots of climate crisis in human activity as part of the problem, or a huge part of the problem. And that is, I think, part of what sets off alarms. Because if you connect human activity to climate crisis, then you have to admit that we could actually do something about it. And transformation is sort of a radical principle, you know, that this thing is not fateful and ordained or meant to be, that human beings could actually collaborate and create a transform themselves and the world they live in.
Yeah, well, the basis of climate change denial, it has deep roots, is people's fears of, in fact, losing their living, losing their settled sort of existence. Because climate change really, if we're going to make everybody sort of knows, if we're going to stop carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas pollution, there's going to have to be sweeping changes of the way we produce, consume, live, design cities. And those changes will be hard, and there's especially lots of companies, not just the fossil fuel companies, who will at best survive as enormously changed sort of productive things under a whole lot of rules and standards that they've never wanted to face. And that's a tremendous challenge. And there's lots of people who just don't want to have to face that, and for whom climate change denial is a convenient thing for them to say, well, it's not proven, it's not clear, the science is not, you know, there's different sides. We'll wait and see. Well, we'll wait and see what happens, which would be absolute cataclysm and catastrophe if we wait much longer.
Right, and literacy, you know, I like the language of climate literacy, because it does imply that one becomes literate, one becomes accountable, and part of that also is about becoming a critical thinker, someone with the ability to not just weigh the balance, but to weigh factors that are often in conflict or have tension, in which you come to a better solution. And the resolution is really strong in its language about using vision and creativity and science and fact and, you know, setting a bar for what and how we talk about this in our educational environments.
Right, this issue or any issue, and that it requires, it seems to be a very sort of sophisticated, and it's not clear to me that I think we're on our way to having it. Challenging climate change denial is a first step. But I think we have to even be more sophisticated about what we mean by science, because science is just it's a system of hypotheses. No scientist will say, I've proven this, and it's just absolute. So many times scientists have thought something, and it turns out that the hypothesis really needs to be reconsidered, and there are some more basic things that are going on, or that they might be wrong, or that that the consequences of whatever these processes they are may have been exaggerated or ignored in one way or another, and by science. The science is constantly being sort of recreated based on findings. It's not an absolute. There are very few absolute findings. There are some things that we're pretty confident of. And that being the case, I think we should acknowledge there's all sorts of things that we still have to learn. There's all sorts of uncertainty. It may well be there'll be countervailing factors. Not that the globe isn't warming. It surely is, and by human, that's pretty clear. But there could be countervailing factors, like a more humid climate in some places and might create tremendous amounts of cloud cover, which would then cool the Earth. I think we have to say that what we have to do is act upon our best science, the things that we think now are clear, and especially since the threat is so great. If the threat wasn't great, we could afford to wait and see, well, exactly what is going to happen. But the threat is immediate and great, so you take insurance out. You do things that not based on absolute certainty, but on your best estimate of what could happen if we don't act. And then we act. It's the precautionary principle that's here at stake. It's not that we're absolutely certain. It's that we're certain enough, and the stakes are so high. I mean, we buy insurance on our home, people who own homes, but people insure themselves against the worst-case scenario. You lose your home, and you're not insured, you've lost your life. So we have to save our planetary life. We're not absolutely certain that it's true, or that there won't be countervailing factors. But it's so serious, the threat, that any sane society would take the considerable sums, but appreciable sums, but not impossible. It's very, really, all the wealth and productivity is there to, in fact, insure ourselves against the worst. But and it seems to me that's what really should be taught. Not that science is infallible and we just have to do it because science is infallible, you know. Anyway, that's my assessment of
right. And I think partly what you're saying is that climate literacy for young people is our insurance, and that in part is terrifying to those who are holding their stakes and holding to their livelihood, which ensures billions of dollars go in one direction and very little goes in the other. There's a lot of language about preparing kids, young people, to actually work in areas where we're making transformations happen. So like you said, it is a good start. There's a lot in there for folks to chew on, and with any luck, we won't scare our kids to death with the urgency of this all, which is also tricky, right?
Yes. Well, it's the richest of curriculums. I mean, it's so rich to look at it because so much is involved. It's so critical. And kids can understand it and study it and take action and have hope. I mean, there's so much hope of a better, that the alternatives to runaway climate change are actually quite wonderful if we can develop these movements that would prevail over, you know, the corporate apparatus now.
Yeah. Well, kids, put down your gadgets and get ready for some activism. That's what we say here on the Old Moles. I'm with Bill Resnick, and I'm Denise Morris. We've been talking about the Portland Public Schools climate justice resolution just passed on May 17th.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg has been our engineer. Musical interludes today have been from that great blues harpist, Charlie Musselwhite. Tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. Today's program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. And this is KBOO Portland. Stay tuned now for Air Cascadia, bringing us news, views, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andrea. At 10:15 is Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest is one of the leaders fighting the Millennium Bulk Terminal's oil export project, Roy Staples. The recent oil train crash in the Columbia River Gorge exemplifies why fossil fuel export terminals are a bad idea. And at 11, Health Watch is off today. Instead, we'll hear more about the recent oil train crash and fire in Mosier in the Columbia River Gorge. And tonight, there will be an oil train rapid response meeting hosted by Portland Rising Tide from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church downtown at 1211 Southwest Main Street, room A108. That's 1211 Southwest Main Street, room A108.
KABU Wednesday, June 8th at 9 a.m. for the second installment of our podcast series on criminalization, produced by the Center for Intercultural Organizing. We'll hear stories about profiling, criminalization, and featured commentary by CIO staff. Again, that's the second program in our criminalization podcast series, one produced by the Center for Intercultural Organizing. Wednesday, June 8th at 9 a.m. here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Thank you.